How will the future buyer look at this asset? How do I ensure I leave this company better than when I found it? And the way to do that is through really thoughtful, almost 2-year plans of what are some of the initial investments we might need to make in years 3 and 4 to start planting the seeds for the next owner so that they can see evidence of that value creation plan and therefore build more conviction in that value creation thesis when they look to buy it.
Welcome to the X Factor, where we visit with proven private equity-backed leaders to unpack a compelling area of value creation to help our listeners gain an edge as they grind toward a liquidity event of their own. X Factor is presented by Private Equity CXO, the world's largest digital community of PE-backed executives. You can find a link to PECXO in the description to start your free membership and unlock exclusive content. I'm your host, Rob Huxtable, a partner at Falcon, a retained executive search firm exclusively recruiting C-level leaders for private equity-owned portfolio companies. So pleased to be joined today by Jen Pereira, who's going to help us pull back the curtain on how private equity investors think through the investment thesis of a portfolio company through its entire life cycle. With that in mind, Jen, thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Just go ahead and tell us a little bit about your background, if you would, please.
Sounds good. So I lead our private equity team here at Fengate Asset Management out of Toronto. We're a mid-market private equity fund sitting inside a multi-asset manager. We have about $8 billion in AUM, and our fund, the private equity fund, has been around since 2016.
Okay, great. What kind of businesses do you like to invest in?
Yeah, so we focus on what I call the lower middle market. Think about it as 5 to 10 million of EBITDA, and we're writing equity checks of anywhere from $25 to $50 million. Ideally, we're looking for founder-backed businesses looking to scale. We market ourselves as transformative growth, and what we mean by that is how can we partner with a great founder to help them have a second bite of the apple and achieve that next level of scale, professionalism, and growth while maintaining the culture that's made them successful so far.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get into this with more specifics, but I'm guessing your investments, some lean more organic growth, others are really hinging on a solid M&A strategy.
Yeah, we run the full gamut. Our team actually has 4 dedicated origination professionals. And why that's important is not only does it help us find great deals and platforms to invest in, but it also helps our portfolio companies find great tuck-in acquisitions to help accelerate their organic growth. We're looking for multiple ways to win, right? So ideally, it's not predicated on any one value creation lever. So as opposed to just growing through M&A, we're also looking for ways that we can improve margins, increase revenues, improve talent, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So as we kind of talk through the unpacking of an investment thesis, I think when you pull back, your garden variety private equity backed executive just sort of understands intuitively that, okay, we're going to try to grow faster than we were. We're going to try to introduce some new products. We're going to work on EBITDA margin expansion. We're going to do some add-on acquisitions. We're going to professionalize. And then we're going to sell at some period of time in the future. And so that's an overly simplified description, but I think it's going to be fun to get behind the scenes of how you think through all of that when underwriting and then governing a deal.
I kind of think about it in 4 stages, right? So you've got sort of your selection and preparation, which is really identifying the target markets you want to invest in, be that industries, sectors, themes, theses. And once you do that, then you can start focusing your efforts in finding the actual companies that you'd like to invest in. And then you kind of move into what I call the, you know, sowing and cultivating phase, where you are really working on value creation plan once you've acquired the asset, or oftentimes before that, executing that plan, building what you need to build, then be able to do phase 3, which is harvesting. Harvesting is when you're starting to realize the benefits of the value that you've created. You're seeing that through increased revenues. You're seeing that through increased margins, increased scale. And you then start turning your attention to sort of that reseeding stage. And that's really the exit value creation piece that we were going to talk about later. How do I set this up, leave it better than I found it for the next buyer or the next investor? Mm-hmm. Maybe double clicking, because you asked about TAM on selection and preparation. You know, you're really looking for markets that have a large enough market size that affords you the ability to grow. We're looking for stable and growing markets. And specifically within that, we're looking for higher growth niches within those markets. I'll give you an example. Overall, food and beverage as a category has grown more or less at inflation in the last several years. Having said that, though, there are pockets within food and beverage that have grown above that. Why? Because they're growing niches. They're often related to things like health and wellness or value convenience. And so if you can find those sleeves within a sector, you can find outsized growth even within a market, which can get you excited as well.
And you're going to pay a little bit more for those type of assets, but they've got more upside. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's the idea. I mean, at the end of the day, we want to have a path to growing revenue. How do we get comfortable with that? Either the market is healthy and growing, you're within a stable market, but you're in a niche that's growing, or you can get a lot of conviction that the company you're about to invest in has the right to win more share within a stable market. Ideally, you check all of those boxes, but I think even one of those can get you comfortable that organic revenue growth is viable.
So, do you have a template or a bucketed model that helps you think through how you're going to cultivate an investment thesis for a new deal?
For sure. I mean, we talk about a value creation plan. So at the first stage where you're screening an investment, first you want to understand, as we talked about, is this an industry, is this a market that I like? Then within that market, are there assets that are of the right size and scale and maturity that I can invest in as a private equity investor? We're often looking to add a bit of leverage to the business we're buying. If we're doing that, we need to make sure there's a history of cash flow. We're looking for market maturity or company maturity, I should say, growth, and competitive differentiation within that market. Once we're satisfied that that exists, we then start to look externally and say, is there a risk that a new entrant could come in and disrupt that competitive tension? Is there a risk that you can no longer roll up that? If it's a roll-up thesis, there may not be enough fragmentation to continue to execute on that roll-up thesis. So you start to look at the individual company, the market dynamics surrounding that business, and if both of those things are true, it probably is worth spending more time on. Then you get into more moving away from market and company into the actual team. How strong is the management team? Do we require any upgrades or are they a strong team that we can back? How healthy is their business? How has it performed historically? How are they expecting it to perform in the future? And where are there differentiated areas where we can further increase value beyond their business as usual outlook for the business?
And jumping back to TAM for just a moment, I think there's kind of a misnomer about it. I think a lot of people just imagine that, well, we're just trying to create this bigger overall universe in which we can compete. But in my mind, it's also a driver for how value gets created that if we're going to expand TAM by way of new product development, okay, new products are going to help drive revenue. If we're going to expand TAM by way of new end markets, that's an exciting opportunity to grow. Maybe new geographies with an acquisition overseas. How does TAM factor into the way you think about a thesis?
It's a great question. So I think the risk, the watch out, is that you define that TAM too broadly and it's not actually, target addressable market. How addressable is it really? And we like to risk that TAM to be able to say, what is our right to win? Where is the business currently succeeding today? Where are they playing? Where are they succeeding? And then as you start to look at new markets, new geographies, new categories, new customers, you start to want to say, okay, well, what risk, what right do I have to win in there? What is required for this company to be successful? And then you start to risk weight the additional kind of layers of TAM that you can go and achieve in your thesis. And what you want to be able to do is when you're underwriting an investment, have multiple paths to value creation. So rather than just going after a thesis where I'm going to go out and win a new client in this channel, I might say, I'm looking to build out a new channel of revenues. I'm looking to develop new products. I'm looking to grow within my existing customers. And I'm also thinking there's some M&A opportunity to add on to that. Okay, so now I have four different things, each with probably different levels of risk, depending on the capabilities of that business and the market they exist in. If I can get comfortable enough on all four of those, and some risk-weighted factor, I should be able to achieve an attractive, what we call a base case return for our business. So, no forecast has ever been achieved to perfection. But ideally, you get to the end of an investment and you say, yeah, we did three out of those five things really well, and we overachieved our base case.
How much does a given investment thesis evolve through the course of a hold period?
I'd say more often than not, it does evolve because markets are uncertain and things change. The fundamentals tend to be true if you get it right. Okay. And so when that is not true is in situations where you have disruption. I've been involved in investments that were bricks and mortar retailers, in the early 2000s. And very quickly, those businesses faced disruption from online entrants. That happened far more quickly than we had expected when we underwrote the investment. And it resulted in a very fast pivot, meaning hiring new management team talent that had experience with digital, investing in a better digital experience, and really rethinking the way we thought about contribution economics for all the channels to make sure that as a retailer, we were also able to be profitable online and really drive both businesses forward. So that is not ideal, but I think it does happen. And the way that you manage that is you have your value creation plan, your thesis at the beginning of an investment. And once that deal is closed, we like to sit down with our management teams, share that plan with them, and collaborate with those teams to make sure that we're on the same page. We know where we're headed together. We're learning what we might be missing, having not been operating the business for several years, and we're tweaking and prioritizing. We then translate that into a 5-year plan and an annual budget every year. As that evolves, as you go through your, annual quarterly board meetings and you start to say, this isn't really working out, you pivot. Like in any good business, you have to be able to pivot. In order to do that effectively, though, I do think you have to have leading indicators. So we rely heavily on communicating, strong reporting with our management teams, and making sure that we're attentive to how we're tracking relative to our original thesis. And if things aren't working out, thinking collaboratively, how do we fix this? Where do we go from here?
And how do you try to discern whether, if things aren't working out, you're within arm's reach, but you're not really there? Was it something that you missed in underwriting versus execution?
It can be both. This is the reality. I think no one has a crystal ball. But I think back to a situation where we were investing in a business that seemed very professionally run when we were investing in it. And so we didn't spend as much time thinking about operations. And once we were on the same side of the table as management and really seeing in detail how those operations were full unfolding, I think what became clear was there were some inefficiencies. And so the question then becomes, how much of a distraction is this? How imperative is it to fix this now versus later? And to the extent that it is core to your thesis, it does mean sometimes, okay, we need to stop, pause our value creation plan, and pivot to how do we increase operating efficiencies? Once we've done that, we get back to the plan and we catch back up. So, I think it's an iterative process. It is a collaborative process. I think if you go in thinking, this is what we underwrote on day one, and we must execute it at all costs, that would be a very rigid approach. And I'm not sure it would be successful given the uncertainty that exists in this investing environment.
Yeah, the analogy that comes to mind is I once heard it said that an airplane only spends about 1% of its time in flight exactly on course, and the other 99% fighting turbulence, temperature, and weather to get back on course. Our audience is primarily executives who are in private equity-backed companies today. What can sitting executives do to help their sponsors stay current on not material changes to the thesis, but how can they best help you see around the corner to make tweaks before maybe they otherwise might be made?
I think it starts with very strong alignment in the beginning. I worry sometimes that in the process of buying an asset or selling an asset, there's a motivation to say what you want the other person, you think the other person wants to hear. And in reality, I think you're much better served to be as direct and transparent as possible, because as long as you have that alignment from the beginning and there is clarity around what the private equity's investment thesis is, and a comfort saying, hey, I don't quite think that's going to work, or okay, I get it, but can you explain X? Investing in that upfront, I think, pays dividends later, because if you have clarity on where we're all headed together, you're more likely to be able to put your hand up and say, actually, something's not working out. If you don't understand that, that's where I think you start to miss things because you don't know what you're missing. You don't know what you're looking for. So I think having that clear path, having a very strong partnership where you feel comfortable having those vulnerable conversations, like, hi, Jen, I just got the monthly flash report, and actually, we're going to be a little short on revenues because of this reason. That level of openness and dialogue is so important because it enables you to do what you just said, pivot quickly before things become major issues. I think it's also about simplistic but strong reporting on the right KPIs. Sometimes there's a risk of analysis paralysis where you get this giant spreadsheet of every possible metric a company could produce and you don't know what you're looking for. I think having very clean and effective reporting in a timely fashion helps surface issues before they become major issues.
You covered off on a lot there. The aspect that really resonated with me is the trust and vulnerability that management and board need to try to achieve together. Because there is some healthy tension between the income statement and the balance sheet and sponsors and management, but you're in it together. My message to our audience is, whether you have a good, healthy, constructive relationship with your sponsor or not, the way to strengthen it further from here is more transparency, more communication, more timely input, and finding ways to, for lack of a better phrase, use them for your own benefit. They want to help you get to liquidity.
That's why we spend a significant amount of time upfront, not only investing in the relationship before we even look at signing a deal to make sure it's a good fit culturally as well as thesis-wise, but then in the early days, thinking about long-term alignment through things like management incentive programs and equity co-investing so that we really are aligned in where we're trying to go, which is an ultimate exit. I think the other part about it is you're right. Private equity funds often have pattern recognition. They've seen this before. They have broad networks. They have capital. They have services that they can use to help their portfolio companies if they know where to help. And so having that two-way dialogue, I probably talk to the CEOs I work with at least once a week, if not more. And those are phone calls away. They're not scheduled chats. They're text messages. They're quick emails. We're all one team. And the more that you can build that one team mentality, when you're going through the deal evaluation stage, you're sitting on the opposite sides of the table. And then suddenly on close, you're on the same side of the table and you're marching toward the same goal. You're right. That is the single biggest value creation driver is that alignment and trust and partnership.
Yeah, great. So we covered off a little bit about how you approach thinking through an investment thesis and how management can play a part in helping you stay in sync and on track and if needed, pivot accordingly. We also talked through the idea that you're preparing product in by way of your company to be very attractive to other private equity firms. So as many of our listeners know, a secondary buyout is when a portfolio company is sold from one private equity firm to another. And, in this modern era, that's more popular than a strategic buyout, in at least the anecdotal side of things. So how do you think through the investment thesis for today, executing on the total enterprise value goal for this hold period, while also thinking through the story that you'd like to be able to tell at exit to get the next buyer not just excited about the business and its historical performance, but the white space that lies ahead for even more accelerated value creation?
And this is so important because while 5 years may seem like a long time, it really isn't. I think the first year is very much about alignment, prioritization, and building trust. Years 2 to 3 are execution. I mean, you could probably say 1 to 3 are execution. And then really by year 3, you're starting to shift from, good to go back to my farming analogy, the seeding and the harvesting to how do I prepare the land for the next crop? Right. And so at that point, you're starting to say, okay, how will the future buyer look at this asset? How do I ensure I leave this company better than when I found it? And the way to do that is through really thoughtful, almost 2-year plans of what are some of the initial investments we might need to make in years 3 and 4 to start planting the seeds for the next owner so that they can see evidence of that value creation plan and therefore build more conviction in that value creation thesis when they look to buy it. What are, potentially some things you might need to clean up to get the story simplified and clear and robust for the next buyer? Who do we need to start talking to? These cycles start well before an auction when you decide you want to sell. If you have a view of who you want to buy your asset, you can start those conversations much earlier and start to test that thesis and refine it accordingly. So I think years 3 to 5 are really when you start to actively think about exit. Having said that, we start thinking about it during underwriting. We start thinking about the next buyer analysis before we've even bought the business, because oftentimes in the middle market and lower middle market, we will be the first institutional capital. As you said, often not the last. One of the primary reasons, and I didn't mention it earlier, but my prior role was in large cap investing. And one of the primary reasons I moved from large cap private equity to middle market private equity was that it's actually a lot easier to think about exit when you're the first investor. Why is that? You're often dealing with businesses that are smaller, that are growing more quickly. M&A is easier because it's more material than when it's a much, much larger business. And therefore, when you start thinking about exit, there's more that that next buyer can still do. Oftentimes, you've done maybe 3 of the 5 things like we talked about. And now those last two things you saved, you've started to prove, but you haven't fully executed. You've left them for the next buyer. So I think that's something that takes discipline from the beginning, but really the work starts in years 3 to 5, so that by the time you're ready to exit, there's a very clear story, there's evidence of how that thesis will play out, and there's thoughtfulness on who that buyer might be, and you maybe have already talked to a few of those potential investors.
Sure. And for our listeners who aren't aware, there are things that bankers arrange, such as fireside chats that are pre-exit, where it's almost like a, my words, not theirs, a focus group of sorts. You get to meet with some upmarket sponsors and gauge their reaction to the story and where you're headed. Doing that 18 to 24 months before a sale can probably be pretty instructive, I would imagine.
Absolutely. I think that there's a natural fear, having those conversations too soon or before you're ready. But to your point, if you view them more as consumer research, really, you're trying to understand what's on that next buyer's mind before you have anything to sell, then that's a really powerful place to be. You're not asking for anything, you're not selling anything, you're just looking for feedback. Wouldn't you want to have that hindsight ahead of time to be able to build it before you take it to sale and then get the feedback and maybe it's too late? So I think that fireside chats are excellent, working with your private equity sponsor to have some really thoughtful conversations is helpful. I think talking to banks can be helpful. At the end of the day, though, you want to maintain some level of optionality and not build something that's so custom built for a single type of buyer that you may potentially limit your exit optionality. So what do I mean by that? I'll often speak with the management teams I'm investing in and say, would you like to sell to a sponsor? Would you like to sell to a strategic? Do you one day want to be public? Do you want to own this forever? Like, help me understand which doors to close, because once we do that, we can focus on achieving a solution that at least optimizes one or two of those exit paths. And the way that you build your business will be a little bit different depending on what it is you're trying to exit to. Coming from a large cap investor and having bought the assets from middle market private equity investors, it's interesting to apply that now foresight to the earlier stage, knowing what a larger cap investor will be looking for.
These areas of white space that we want to be able to at least incubate and demonstrate some initial success so that the buyer can see that, okay, this is a toehold that we can kind of leverage off of. How much of those items are dating back to, yeah, we kind of had a clue about that when we first underwrote this business versus as we've owned the company, they've kind of become apparent and we settled on them that way. I'm sure it's a blend, but how do you see that unfolding?
A lot of this is not revolutionary, right? And so if you think about what are the classic levers, it's like growing organically. How do we do that? We capture more market share by introducing new products or winning new customers or entering new channels or going to new geographies, right? You almost think of it like a driver tree. We improve our margins by raising our prices or premiumizing or mixing, shifting our mix, I should say, to higher end products. We reduce our cost base. We operate more efficiently. And then, are there new avenues we can explore through M&A where we don't have any core competencies today, but we can acquire that talent? That's kind of how you think about value creation. So you sort of know what the menu is, and you're unlikely to be surprised by something brand new showing up on that menu. Rather, I think what can change is your conviction in each of those. Once you start going through the thesis, and maybe the world is changing as you go, certain elements might become more attractive than others, and you want to focus your exit thesis on those. What you don't want to do is be all over the place. So I think simplicity and clarity in the narrative, making it easier for that potential buyer to understand the value proposition, is really critical.
So if I'm hearing you right, let's just accept that if you map out the future of any one company, let's say it's traded across four different private equity firms over a 20-year period, with some degree of accuracy, we can imagine what will become of that company. You know, in terms of how it will grow and how it will evolve. And we can kind of map those pathways out. And based on where we are in the life cycle of that trade, we can sort of say, okay, these are maybe the six or seven things the next buyer will likely do. What two or three of those things are we best positioned to execute on and demonstrate at least a proof of concept so that we can have a better story to tell at exit?
Absolutely. So like, let's put that into some examples to make it a little more clear. If you're a manufacturing business, how much capacity are you going to have at exit? If you're going to be near capacity utilization, that's probably not a great exit story, because the next buyer is going to have to underwrite significant capital expenditure to be able to continue to grow. So you can get ahead of that. In year three or four, you might commission a study to say, how can I improve the efficiencies of my plants? You might start to invest some CapEx to start increasing that capacity. Again, leaving it better than you found it. You don't want to sell something that really doesn't have a lot of runway. That's not going to be very attractive to a future buyer. So it's making those investments thoughtfully early on so that you leave something for that next buyer. We often do what we call a strategy day, which is often midway through an investment. We'll sit down with our board and our management team. We might invite in a select group of advisors that we highly respect in the space. And we get perspectives on how's the market evolved since we first made this investment? Where are our peers trading? Where can we capture value through? Is there an opportunity, for example, to increase exposure in a certain service line and therefore trade at a higher multiple at exit, because that's a more, attractive form of business than where we're weighted to today? That's the mix shift. Is there a scale factor that we can count on? We should be focused on M&A. So we'll do these full day sessions where first we'll hear from advisors who are in the market every day, talking to the competition, talking to future buyers, have a real pulse. And they'll kind of say to us, this is the lay of the land. These are the things you can do. And then as a team, as a board, as a management team together, we say, so what are we best placed to go after? What do we want to solve for? And maybe the answer is we're going to focus on M&A in the US in this particular section. We'll also worry about, organic growth in Canada, but that's the way we're going to create value and having that focus, because what you can't do is you can't try to do everything. Otherwise, you're not going to do anything particularly well. Having the clarity on what is going to have the maximum value for your future buyer and focusing there, I think you have to do that early on. Probably midway through your investment is when you need to start doing that.
Sounds to me like the mix of the story really matters. That if you're understandably overly focused on organic growth and margin optimization at the expense of some of these other things, yes, you may have a great growth and margin story to tell, but you're going to be left, you know, with an empty page when it comes time to talk about the exit thesis that the next buyer can get excited about.
I also don't think that's necessarily a completely bad thing, because you've left something untapped for the next buyer. So long as you can demonstrate that there are actionable M&A targets out there and that the market is viable for that M&A, that could be actually very exciting to the next buyer, because they'll say, well, you've done everything you can on margin and growth. Fantastic. We're really great at M&A. We can help you there. Conversely, we'll often see businesses that grew very quickly through M&A, but maybe didn't take the time to integrate, didn't take the time to think about efficiencies. And so there's a real opportunity. Now they have scale to improve margin. So I don't think you have to have done both, but you have to have a view on both.
Yeah, makes sense. Well, this has been great. I think just to maybe summarize some takeaways for our audience, number one, for me, communication, the analogy I always think of is, private equity is kind of like headquarters. You've got all the intel, all the satellites, you've got the information, you've got the supercomputers, management teams out on the frontier doing the hard work, and you're trying to provide them with cover, information, and intel to guide their steps, but you can't do that as efficiently as you otherwise would if you don't know what's happening on the ground real time. So I think communication here feeds into both the investment thesis as well as the exit thesis. Having, I guess, an invested mentality as an executive team member to want to play a part and not just be a one-dimensional type of resource focused only on execution, even though that's the priority. What else would you say are the takeaways for our audience in terms of how they can lend a better hand on the both buckets of this thesis conversation?
If you are thinking about working with a private equity firm, really investing early on in understanding the fit, asking hard questions. Recently, I had an experience where we were diligencing a business and they were looking at bringing in institutional capital for the first time. And we, of course, sent them our hundreds and hundreds of diligence questions. And for the first time in my 12-year career, I got an email back with 30 questions for me. And I thought that was incredibly refreshing because it showed me that this is a management team or a founder, I should say, that genuinely cares about finding the right partner and is asking the tough questions early on to figure that out. I love that because it means to me that we're a bit more likely, if we do work together, to be aligned, to have a successful investment horizon. Versus making assumptions, maybe not doing that work, or being afraid to ask those harder questions up front, only to discover later there's a point of misalignment or poor fit. So I think doing your counter diligence early on your prospective investors and making sure that you both see the world the same way, can work together well, can communicate well is very important. I think the other takeaway is that VCs aren't static. As the investment runs its course, being ready to pivot and working together on finding the next route forward, you're a team. And that is how you set yourself up for success, is not running away from a problem, but facing it early and pivoting accordingly. I think those would be the big two things for me.
Yeah, great. And I'll just touch briefly in closing on the first topic you covered. My heart goes out to executives because when they look at these roles, they're met with messaging from sponsors that say, "We partner with management." And they say it with a twinkle in their eye, and they all mean it. But the way that they define partnering runs a radical gamut. And my partner, Lindsay, and I have often joked, if you could just rearrange all the existing C-suite executives into better fit scenarios, sponsors, that would be a real positive. You mentioned you were happy to answer questions that were diligencing your approach. I guess that's probably the biggest encouragement for folks is don't be afraid to lean in and dig in and evaluate this entity that you're going to be married to and be spending more time actually than you are your partner for the next 5 years. So you might as well dig in accordingly.
You want to stress test the relationship. You want to see how your potential partner reacts when they feel vulnerable or they're being asked tough questions. So, check references, ask to speak to CEOs in their portfolio, ask them about investments that didn't go so well or didn't go according to plan, and ask to speak to those management teams. If you're not getting that access, I would be very wary. I don't think there's a single investment team that's never made a mistake, but I think it's the way that you navigate those mistakes and the way you partner when things are tough that is really a testament to what you mean by partnership, right? And so I would encourage executives, when you're considering working with a private equity firm, do your due diligence. And if you're not getting the answers you feel comfortable with, that's probably indicative of what you can expect.
Yeah, and I would add to that for the folks in the audience, when you do get an offer, they are really hoping you accept. So there's no better time than to really dig in and feel like you've got room to move on diligence and ask appropriate questions. And even if they grouse a little bit about it, deep down inside, they're excited Because as I always remind our clients when we're finishing up searches and diligence unfolds on the candidate side, the best and brightest dig in the most and with the greatest depth. Anyway, well, Jen, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for your time today and unpacking a topic that is, I think, glossed over all too often. And I think we were able to pull back the curtain a bit and give our audience some food for thought. Thank you so much. And to our members, if you ever run across an executive opportunity at a Fengate-backed company, I'd say stop what you're doing and take a real close look, because that could be a good opportunity.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Thanks for the time today.
Okay, Jen, thank you so much. Be sure to tune in to our next episode. I'm your host, Rob Huxtable, and thank you for listening to The X Factor.